You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. When Jennifer Doudna was in sixth grade, she came home one day to find that her dad had left a paperback titled The Double Helix on her bed. She put it aside, thinking it was one of those detective tales she loved. And when she read it on a rainy Saturday, she discovered she was right in a way. As she sped through the pages, she became enthralled by the intense drama behind the competition to discover the code of life. Even though her high school counselor told her girls didn't become scientists, she decided she would. Driven by a passion to understand how nature works and to turn discoveries into inventions, she and her collaborators turned a curiosity of nature into something that will transform the human race, an easy-to-use tool that can edit DNA. Known as CRISPR, this technology will allow us to cure diseases, fend off viruses, and have healthier babies. Now, Walter Isaacson, the best-selling author of Leonardo da Vinci and Steve Jobs, has written a gripping account of how this Nobel Prize-winning scientist launched a revolution that has opened a brave new world of medical miracles and moral questions. The book is called The Codebreaker, Jennifer Doudna, Gene Editing, and the Future of the Human Race. And today, Walter Isaacson joins me on the podcast to share how Doudna blazed a trail in a scientific field dominated by men and discovered how to use genetics to combat deadly diseases. He discusses the high-stakes rivalries among many of the pioneers in this field, the controversy of so-called designer babies, and how the COVID pandemic is bringing old enemies together and changing opinions about the potential of gene editing our offspring. Plus, Walter talks about his mission to get people excited about science and the common trait that links all geniuses from Albert Einstein to Leonardo da Vinci. Coming up with best-selling author Walter Isaacson, in just a moment. Walter Isaacson, a professor of history at Tulane University, has been CEO of the Aspen Institute, chair of CNN, and editor of Time Magazine. He's the author of Leonardo da Vinci, The Innovators, Steve Jobs, Einstein, His Life and Universe, Benjamin Franklin, An American Life, and Kissinger, A Biography, and the co-author of The Wise Men, Six Friends and the World They Made. Now he's written a new biography about a modern-day bioscience revolution and the pioneer behind it called The Codebreaker, Jennifer Doudna, CRISPR, and the Future of the Human Race. Walter Isaacson, welcome to the show.
Hey, Ben, it's great to be on your show.
Well, it's great to have you. Now, you're in New Orleans, right? You moved back there a year or two ago?
I'm in New Orleans. It's nice and sunny and mild here, but we just missed Mardi Gras. We ended up having to cancel it.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's interesting how even Mardi Gras sort of adapted to COVID. Did you do the whole thing of, you know, turning your house into a Mardi Gras float?
Like we have a balcony here on Royal Street, and we certainly decorated it, but I couldn't keep up with some of my friends who truly made float houses.
Royal Street. So you're right in the middle of the quarter, I guess.
Right behind the cathedral.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. What a great spot. Well, Walter, I've been wanting to have you on the podcast for some time now, and so I'm completely delighted to finally have a chance to talk to you. But I'll be honest, when I first heard that you wrote a book called The Codebreaker, I kind of assumed in my mind, oh, goody, this must be about Bletchley Park and maybe the Enigma machine or something. And so I admit that I was a little bit crestfallen when I realized that it was about gene editing and CRISPR.
Hey, that's a new form of coding. You know, we've gone through the digital revolution, which was all past 50 years of based on binary codes. I think the new revolution is going to be combining people who know how to code computers with people who know how to code ourselves yeah. in terms of DNA and RNA. And the ability to edit our genetic material is going to be the most important innovation, the most important advance of our lifetime, and hit us with the most moral questions. And how do we design our babies? How do we make ourselves not susceptible to viruses? How do we use RNA to make vaccines? So I actually think that the bio revolution is going to be even more exciting than the digital yeah. revolution.
Like I said, I thought it was about code breaking in the traditional sense, but the story that you weave is every bit as thrilling as anything I've read over the past year. In fact, the way you describe it, and even the way Jennifer Doudna describes it, the study of DNA is a bit of a detective story. Walk us through that comparison.
Yes. When she was a young sixth grader, she found her dad had left on the bed the double helix, which is James Watson's description of how he and Crick and Rosalind Franklin discovered the structure of DNA. And she thought it was a detective story because there was a little paperback. And then when she finally picked it up a couple of weeks later, she realized she was right. It really is a detective story. It's about hunting for the clues about how does something work. And it's always joyful to discover how something works, especially when that something is ourselves. And so she took this great joy and she decided, hey, I'm going to become a scientist. Of course, her high school guidance counselor told her, well, girls don't become scientists. But this really drove her to want to do it. And what she did was she discovered the structure of RNA, how RNA was probably the molecule that started life on this planet. And then with CRISPR, this gene editing technology that she helped develop from looking at the way bacteria fight viruses, she was able to make a tool that uses RNA and attaches it to something like a scissors and allows it to target a piece of our DNA and cut it where we might want to. In other words, to change one of our genes.
Yeah, it really is a bioscience revolution. Now, there have been several stars in the field of genetics and then more recently in this area of gene editing. Why did you choose to focus specifically on Jennifer Doudna?
Well, I was lucky because she ended up with her partner, Emmanuel Charpentier, winning the Nobel Prize a couple of months ago. So she ends up being the person most acclaimed for this discovery of how CRISPR can be used to edit genes. So to me, she was the example of the most persistent, most exciting scientist pursuing this. And then she turns her attention to the coronavirus, to COVID. And what did we learn from the fight to figure out how to edit our genes that we might use in the fight against viruses such as the coronavirus? And finally, she was a person who's been most in the lead at helping to figure out the ethical issues involved. Mm-hmm. Should we create designer babies? Should we edit traits into our own children that we might want them to have? And so to me, it's always good to have a central character, whether it's a movie or a book. And she's the central character because she's interested in everything from the basic science to the medical tools to the ethical issues.
And now it also struck me that this is your first book about a woman. You've written about Ben Franklin, Einstein, Jobs, Kissinger, Da Vinci. You even have one titled The Wise Men. Since the Me Too movement, there's been a renewed drive for equal opportunity and recognition for women and their accomplishments. Did that factor in your decision to write this book?
No, I really wanted to write about genetic editing and this ability to make these new types of vaccines and how biotechnology was going to be the revolution of the next 20 or 30 years. I mean, we worry about teaching our kids how to code. And as you said earlier, we're usually talking about, you know, digital coding. But I think we have to inspire this next generation to combine that with the ability to do, you know, genetic coding to figure out how our cells work. That said, women have often been written out of the history of technology and the history of science. I wrote about Ada Lovelace in my book, The Innovators, and she was the person who came up with the first real computer algorithm, but she's not well known to history. In this biology revolution we're going into, women have been at the forefront, especially when it comes to figuring out how to use tools based on RNA. There's a woman at the University of Pennsylvania who figured out how do you make messenger RNA work. And that's in the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines that we've all been getting. Likewise, Jillian Banfield, Emmanuel Charpentier, Jennifer Doudna, they're the heroes of the book, The Codebreaker, that I just wrote, because they've been at the forefront of this revolution in the life sciences. Mm-hmm. So I think that just like Jennifer Doudna was told by her high school guidance counselor, girls don't do science, it's nice to have role models of women who have been really important in the field of science and technology. But to me, the field is exciting, who's ever involved in it. I hope kids of both genders will pick up this book or their parents will read it and hand it to their kids and say, hey, this is a detective story you might be interested in.
Yeah, it's interesting. You describe how Jennifer Doudna's parents really encouraged her curiosity and interest in science. And you say that there were always science books around the house. And as you mentioned, at one point, I think she was only in sixth grade, her dad leaves this book on her bed, The Double Helix, which is not probably an easy read for an 11 or 12 year old. That's probably pretty challenging. And she really took to it. I think there's something to say there about encouraging young people to take an interest in science and specifically now biosciences, because I think you see that as really the future here.
I think that if we're intimidated by science, if we say to ourselves, oh, I can't understand science, first of all, we're missing something of beauty. It'd be like saying, oh, I can't understand, you know, Picasso, or I can't understand Shakespeare. You know, we would never try to brag about that we didn't understand a work of literature. And yet sometimes some of us go around and say, oh, I don't get science or whatever. Well, the science of genetic editing and creating vaccines is actually not only beautiful, but it's pretty easy to understand. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hoping that people say, I get it. Nature is beautiful. It's a wonderful detective story to figure out how nature works. And I want to make sure that my kids share that excitement. So I want people to read this book and get excited about how beautiful and miraculous nature can be and how we can understand it. But I also want them to encourage their kids to read the book, because I'd like to turn out more Jennifer Doudnas, or for that matter, more Steve Jobses or Bill Gates, people who can really understand how to take us into a new world of science and technology.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned a moment ago that a lot of times women have made all kinds of accomplishments in scientific fields, but they don't necessarily get the same recognition as their male counterparts. And at the time when Jennifer Doudna entered her field, most of the research, interestingly, was centered on DNA, not RNA. And the DNA research was largely dominated by men. To what degree was her decision to focus on what you describe as sort of a backwater in biochemistry influenced by that? And perhaps there were more opportunities for women in her branch of research just because it didn't seem particularly sexy or promising as the research into DNA.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Certainly in the late 1990s, all the alpha males were rushing towards the Human Genome Project to sequencing DNA, and there were very, very few women involved. Jennifer, when she was growing up, liked to play soccer, and she said she always liked to be playing the positions that other people weren't playing or being in the field where others weren't, because she felt that there was more running room. And I think that's the case when it came to RNA. You know, RNA is not nearly as famous as DNA, but it turns out to be the much more important and interesting molecule than its sibling DNA. I mean, DNA just sits in the nucleus of our cell, you know, curating our genetic information, doesn't really go out and do anything. RNA takes that information and goes to the part of the cell where you build proteins and tells that region of the cell which proteins to build. So it actually goes out and does some work rather than just sitting at home curating information. And I think that appealed to Jennifer Doudna, and she and a group of women became pioneers in this effort to understand RNA. And what has that gotten us? It's gotten us these new coronavirus vaccines. Yeah. It's gotten us these new genetic editing tools. So if I had to say, what's the molecule of the century, I'd say RNA, not DNA.
Well, to go back to James Watson, Watson and Crick discovered the structure of DNA, I think in like something like 1961. And then we had decades where we kind of sat on it and didn't really know what to do with it until very recently. And now here we are in the midst of this whole new scientific revolution. Why was there such a big gap between the pioneering work of Watson and Crick and the pioneering work of people like Jennifer Doudna?
Yeah, Watson and Crick, building on the work of Rosalind Franklin, another woman who's been not gotten enough due in the history of science, in 1953 comes up with the structure of DNA. And as you said, he publishes his book in 1961. But knowing the structure didn't mean we could read our whole genome. It took until about the year 2000 to do all the sequencing necessary to say, here's what the human genome looks like. Here's the sequence of letters that tells you your eye color. Here's a sequence of letters that tells you you might get sickle cell anemia or cystic fibrosis. And that was all important, but even that didn't help very much. Even after we sequenced it, we said, well, yeah, that's a good book, but what do we want to do if we need to rewrite it? In other words, we could read our DNA, but we couldn't write it. And that's where Jennifer Doudna and her team comes in, because what gene editing allows us to do, what CRISPR and other gene editing tools allow us to do, is not only read our genetic code, but rewrite it. And that can be miraculous, and it can be wonderful. But it also can be a little bit frightening to say, okay, let's rewrite the code of life. When they gave her and Emmanuel Charpentier the Nobel Prize this past year, they said, this is about rewriting the code of life.
I think I have a pretty good grasp of how gene editing works, but sometimes I have a little bit of a hard time explaining it. And I guess the way I would say it is it's a form of, for lack of a better word, weaponizing something that happens naturally in the body between bacteria and viruses, right? Can you explain how that works?
Yeah, bacteria for more than a billion years have been fighting viruses, which is quite useful for us to know now that we're fighting viruses the way we are. And one way they do it is they can take a little snapshot of the genetic code of a virus that attacks them. And whenever that virus attacks again, they have this sort of scissors-like thing called an enzyme that they can guide and chop up the attacking virus. Now, what Jennifer Doudna and her team were able to do is say, well, let's use that to look at the 3 billion or so base pairs of our DNA and say, what would we do if we wanted to change the DNA in our body? What would we want to do if we wanted to rewrite some of our genes, to change some of our genes? And so what CRISPR does is it says, okay, it can be programmed to look at the gene that may cause you to develop a receptor, say, for the virus that causes AIDS, or maybe the receptor for the virus that causes COVID. And maybe we can go in and chop up that gene and replace it so that you're not as susceptible to getting viruses. That's the way it could work. But of course, you got to be real careful when you're messing with Mother Nature.
Right. And yet you definitely get into that in this book and some of the ethical questions around it. You also outline, I guess, 3 main areas of potential for CRISPR technology, or 3 main uses for it. What are those?
I think that you can use CRISPR technology to edit genes, and we can cure diseases. We've already, this past year, cured somebody of sickle cell anemia, a really painful disease. We can use it to fight cancers, for immunotherapy, to have our own cells be the ones that manufacture ways to fight cancer cells. Also, and this is the most controversial part, we can edit embryos or sperm or reproductive cells so that we can create inherited genes in our children. In other words, not just fix a living patient, but say we want our children to be not susceptible to certain viruses. We want our children to be taller or to have more muscle mass and maybe even have better memory or different skin color, whatever you want. And those genetic edits that are done in reproductive cells or in early stage embryos, those are inherited. So you're not just editing the genes of a person, you're changing the entire human race.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. You actually talk about in this book a dream that Jennifer Doudna had at one point that really got her thinking seriously about the moral aspect of all of this. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah. After she had developed with Emmanuel Charpentier and others this tool to edit genes, CRISPR, it was called CRISPR-Cas9, she gets told in this nightmare that she has that somebody wants to meet her. And she goes into the room and meets the person, and the person looks up and it's Adolf Hitler. And she flinches. And for days afterwards, she can't sleep. So she starts organizing scientists around the world, you know, from England to China and others, to be part of these discussions about, yes, this is a miracle technology, CRISPR. We can fight Huntington's disease, sickle cell anemia, cystic fibrosis. We can even do things that make healthier kids. But where are we going to draw the line? Are we going to create enhanced soldiers? Are we going to make it so that the rich can buy better genes for their kids and the poor people can buy for their kids and take inequalities and encode it into the human race? Are we going to get rid of some of the diversity in our society? Like, you know, maybe edit out things that parents may not want, but add to the richness and texture of the human species. And so one reason I wanted to write this book is the science is so fascinating. The detective hunt for making it work is so much fun to read about. But then we get to the part of now what? You know, what do we do now that, like Prometheus, we've snatched fire from the gods, or like Adam and Eve, we've bitten into the apple of knowledge? What are we going to do? And Jennifer's work in figuring out what should be the rules of the road totally, I think, will spark a whole lot of dinner table debates about what should we allow people to do when it comes to editing and designing their babies.
Yeah, and the inflection point for this debate was sort of in 2018 when the world's first designer babies were born. They were twin girls in China with genes that had been edited with CRISPR to make them immune to the virus that causes AIDS. This prompted almost universal condemnation in the scientific community. You know, for me, I have to wonder, why was that so problematic? I mean, I get that it's a slippery slope, but it's not as if they were engineering them to have 180 IQ or be 6 feet tall. He was trying to safeguard them against a deadly disease. What's wrong with that?
Hey, by the way, what's wrong with editing a kid to have 180 IQ or be 6 feet tall? We have to ask ourselves those questions, too, right. Which is, hey, would it be wrong to have a society that's smarter or perhaps even taller? But as to your question about the rogue Chinese scientists who did it, there were a couple of things that were wrong. First of all, it wasn't ready. It wasn't safe, the technology. He created these two twin girls, you know, using with designer genes. But we don't know what unintended consequences they might have. And the parents, they didn't give the full consent. So it was somebody who was rushing ahead, trying to make headlines without it being safe. But the deeper question is, once it is safe, once we could do those type of things and edit our kids not to be susceptible, say, to getting AIDS, would there be anything wrong with that? And my answer at first, and so Jennifer Doudna had the same answer, was, that just doesn't feel right. It feels bad to me. But as I've watched this COVID crisis hit, and if I've studied this more, I've changed my mind. I think we can draw clear rules of the road that say things like, we should use it for medically necessary procedures that will protect us from horrible diseases, mutations, disabilities. But we should draw a line and say, as you did in your question, we should wait a while and pause before we start trying to enhance our children. In other words, if they're going to be born healthy, we shouldn't do things to try to make them have super advantages, like much better eyesight, much better IQ. That's not safe now. It'll be a few decades before we'll be able to do it. But it's useful now to start the discussion and for all of us to understand how it could work so that we can be informed participants when we debate this over dinner.
Yeah, as I understand it, traditionally the line that many scientists have drawn on the ethical front has something to do with the distinction between treating people who currently have a particular disease versus genetically modifying offspring, like you said, as a preventative measure against future disease. It sounds like even that line is starting to shift more recently, huh?
Yeah, the lines are somewhat blurry. I do think it's very easy to draw a line between treating a living patient versus treating an unborn, you know, embryo or sperm or egg. Because what you do when you do early stage reproductive cells, it means that you edit it for all future generations, all of their children and all of their descendants. So that's a bit of a higher bar you have to have if you're going to mess with Mother Nature that way.
And to get back to Jennifer Doudna and her story, I think one of the most interesting parts of this book is actually the rivalries that emerge between Doudna and Berkeley and a scientist named Feng Zhang at Harvard. Can you tell us a little bit about that part? Because I think that's one of the most entertaining and dramatic aspects of this book.
Well, like any wonderful competition, this was, it's a wonderful story between people who were racing to make these discoveries. And that's why this book is not only a detective story, it's sort of a, you know, great race, a great competition. So you had Jennifer Doudna and her partners, including Emmanuel Charpentier, based in Europe and, of course, at Berkeley. And they were racing against Feng Zhang and some brilliant people at MIT and Harvard. Now, Jennifer Doudna and her team are the first to be able to show how does CRISPR work and how could it edit genes? But then there was a next step, and that happens in January 2013, when you say, okay, we figured out how CRISPR works. Let's see if we can make it work in human cells, not just in a test tube. And Feng Zhang, this wonderful character in my book, born in China, raised in Iowa, a deep, earnest, interesting guy, working with Eric Lander, who's the new science advisor and cabinet minister in the Biden administration. They're able to beat, by just a few weeks, Jennifer Doudna's team and showing how it could work in humans. I think competition often spurs us on, whether you're competing, as you know, we might in journalists to get the scoop, or scientists to make the discovery. I like competition. So did Jennifer Doudna. And so this book is about the great race.
Now, one of the interesting side effects of the COVID battle is that a lot of these competitors, these old rivals, are suddenly laying down their swords and actually working together as part of all hands on deck approach to defeating this virus. Do you think that this new sense of teamwork might even last beyond the immediate crisis?
Well, I sure hope so. And one of the things about my book that turned out to be interesting to me is that just as I was writing it, we get hit with the COVID crisis and the people I'm writing about decide to turn their attention, how to use RNA to guide things that happen in our cells. They turn their attention to fighting COVID. And they do so in a way, as you said, that has a little bit more cooperation involved in competition, because the people racing to create CRISPR then have been involved in patent battles or who gets the patent to this part of the discovery or that part of the discovery. But when it came to fighting COVID, and this is the last quarter of my book, the race to use these wonderful new tools we have to fight the coronavirus pandemic, they start making these discoveries and immediately publishing them openly and making it so that anybody can use them, and not trying to patent the discoveries, but allowing people to build upon them. And so science has always been about competition and about cooperation. It's also been about getting patents on intellectual property, but also doing things for the common good. And I think the balance has now shifted back to, we're in this for a noble reason. We're in a noble pursuit to help our fellow human beings, and we're doing it for the common good, not simply to get patents. And so whether it's Jennifer Doudna or the team led by Fong Zhang, they've made detection technologies, they've made ways to directly cure people with COVID in the future. Those type of things, I think, are great and will just benefit the human race. It's a noble pursuit, research is.
Yeah, and on the vaccination front, I mean, vaccines have changed very little over the past couple of centuries. One probably could argue that there have been more advances in vaccination in the past year of COVID than in the past 200 years. Do you think that's right?
Yeah, you know, we go back to Edward Jenner. I can't remember exactly what it was, a couple hundred years ago, I think. And he took a tiny bit of cowpox, which was a way the cows got smallpox, and inoculated by putting a smear of it in a cut on the son of his gardener. And they tried to figure out, how does inoculation work? And then later on, we figured out how to make vaccines that mimic a germ, and so that our immune system kicks in and fights it, and you get injected with a little bit of that. That's the way we've been doing it for a century or two. In the past year or two, we figured out ways to say, we don't have to manufacture all these synthetic, you know, germs and vaccines. We can instead use RNA to instruct our own cells to make the antigens, they're called, to make the little pieces of protein that will cause our system to develop immunity, to develop resistance to those germs. And so Pfizer, Moderna, and a whole lot of others, including the AstraZeneca one from Oxford University, which edits a gene into a delivery system so they can go in our body, we're now making a huge leap in vaccinations. And by the way, everybody should be excited about that, because it's getting us, as we speak, out of this pandemic.
Yeah, there's been some concern, though, that the vaccines currently in circulation might not be effective against new strains like the British and the South African strains. But from what I understand, or from what I've been told, it sounds like these RNA vaccines are actually made to be able to adapt to fight these new strains. Is that true?
Yeah, you talked about code breakers at the beginning, being people who do, you know, codes during the wartime using digital coding. And they could change the code overnight. They could change the code breaking overnight. The good thing about an RNA vaccine is it would really take, once you have a new sequence of a new variant of the virus that comes along, and you're worried about that variant. At the moment, the vaccines we have are pretty good against the variants, but soon we'll have variants that have different sequences. And it might take 2-3 days at most for somebody to take the sequences of the new variations of a virus that's attacking us and say, okay, I've encoded a new RNA vaccine, and this new RNA vaccine will fight it. So instead of taking 8 years to create a new vaccine, we'll be able to do it in a matter of weeks and get them, you know, encased in delivery mechanisms in a matter of a month or so. And this is a true turning point in our hundreds of thousands of year war as Homo sapiens, as humans, against viruses. I think finally we've developed a weapon that, you know, will put us to the advantage of viruses.
Wow. I mean, that is just jaw-dropping.
It's a wonderful story. I mean, that's why I loved writing about it. And that's why I want people to be excited about it. People get intimidated by these things. Science is actually beautiful, and I hope I make it really easy in this book, because it's a gorgeous thing. It's a joy to understand how our bodies work.
Yeah, and all of your biographies have celebrated science and innovation, perhaps with the exception of Kissinger, I guess. But, you know, here we are at a time where it almost feels like America is sort of in a new dark age, with a large number of people favoring conspiracy theories and junk science over real science. Do you see that as part of your mandate to elevate science?
I think it's part of our mandate, your mandate, Ben, Jennifer Doudna's mandate or whatever, which is not only to elevate science, but say, let us, you know, let's explain it right. Let's make it seem smart and interesting. Let's make it not seem intimidating or complicated. Because when people are intimidated by something, or they think it's a mystery, or they think it might be a conspiracy, then they're not going to trust it. But if I say, here's how a kid in sixth grade became turned on by how certain things in nature worked, and here's how she discovered how RNA is shaped and how that causes things like the ability to edit genes, I think the more people understand the process of science, the process of research, the more it'll seem less like a conspiracy and more like something that's really, really cool. Just like, you know, a great basketball game is really cool. And so I hope to demystify science. And I know you do that, you know, with this podcast. But it's not like we have to preach to people to trust science. We have to share the beauties of it so that everybody can feel how it can be ennobling and useful in our lives.
And in addition to this latest book, you've written a number of very well-regarded biographies of other brilliant innovators, Leonardo da Vinci, Einstein, Benjamin Franklin, Steve Jobs as well. Is there a common denominator or a formula for genius that you've detected over these years?
If I had to do it in one word, a word that you and I and all of our kids could embrace, it's curiosity. Hmm. You know, whether it's Einstein as a six-year-old looking at a compass and saying, how does that needle keep pointing north? Nothing's touching it. Why does it move? Or Leonardo da Vinci looking at the sky and saying, why is it blue? Or why do the wings of a bird flap up slower than they flap down? Or it's Jennifer Doudna looking at a piece of grass as she's growing up in Hawaii and touching it and it curls, saying, okay, what makes that curl? Steve Jobs, endlessly, you know, curious. Ben Franklin, you know, sort of taking the temperature of the water in the Atlantic to try to figure out how the Gulf Stream works. That type of curiosity about everything. I mean, whether it's Leonardo or, Ben Franklin or Jennifer Doudna, they care about art, they care about anatomy, they care about music, they care about medicine, they care about math. If you have curiosity, you're going to be more creative.
Do you think that we have a curiosity deficit these days? I mean, it seems like a lot of people aren't asking enough questions.
Yeah, I don't think kids have a curiosity deficit. You're always watching kids and they're asking a whole lot of questions. And they'll be walk through an airport and you see kids saying, why is that light doing this? Or why is the plane backing up? Whatever. Right. And finally, we grown-ups do what we always do to kids, which is we say, quit asking so many stupid questions. And I think the goal is we should all learn, including grown-ups like myself, never outgrow your wonder years. Always ask questions.
Good advice. Well, before we go, I have to ask about another one of your books, Leonardo da Vinci, which is being developed as a movie by another Leonardo, Leo DiCaprio. Can you tell us anything about where that stands?
Look, I understand science. I love how things work in a human cell. I love art. I love how the Mona Lisa got painted by Leonardo. I love statecraft and how Benjamin Franklin created a declaration and a constitution that has lasted for centuries. There's one thing I don't understand, and that's Hollywood. I can't figure out what they're doing.
Okay. Well, I hope it's sooner or later it makes it to the screen, because just what a fascinating story.
I do think we want to, by the way, they're just selling the rights to this book, The Codebreaker.
Oh, great.
And to me, that's important too, because we want to have people inspired to love science and to maybe do their own questioning, their own curiosity, their own research. So I'd love somebody to see movies about people like Jennifer Doudna, as well as read a book about them and say, oh yeah, I get it. I want to be curious just like that.
Absolutely. Well, it's just a fantastic book. Again, the title is The Codebreaker, Jennifer Doudna, CRISPR, and the Future of the Human Race. Walter Isaacson, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks again to Walter Isaacson for coming on the show. The Codebreaker, Jennifer Doudna, CRISPR, and the Future of the Human Race is available on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Subscribe to his podcast, Trailblazers with Walter Isaacson, wherever you get your podcasts, and follow him on Twitter at Walter Isaacson. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit KickAssNews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@KickAssNews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.